are again. It's always such a pleasure. Remember when you tried to kill me twice?
I'm Levi, and this is the Pratfalls Podcast, a show that features conversations with people who make and do cool, creative things. This is my conversation with Amanda White. She's currently the managing director at Mixed Blood Theater, the co-artistic director of Dalico Arts, and a general awesome person. She just speaks really eloquently and passionately about making art, being an artist, being a person. Talking to her was delightful. Even editing this episode made me feel inspired, so I think you guys will really appreciate that. A few things before we get into the conversation. The Pratfalls Podcast is a part of Noise Picnic. You can go to noisepicnic.com. It's a great podcast network based in the Twin Cities full of cool, weird podcasts. Go check those out. Also, you can find me on Twitter, @ThatLevi. I'd love to hear what you think about the show, who you think should be future guests. I keep finding awesome people, but you know awesome people too. Somebody who's interesting, does cool stuff, and might want to talk to me. Those are my parameters, so send me a message @ThatLevi. All right, enough plugginess. Let's get into my conversation with Amanda. You're Amanda T.G. White?
Amanda White T.G., oh, but honestly, sorry. I just kind of go by Amanda White.
That's better. You don't want the baggage of your husband's name. It's...
That dude.
It's, my wife is the same. It's like, if people find out, I won't change it, but
right.
I'm not going to make it a whole thing.
Right.
And I know you're, one of your job titles is managing director of Mixed Blood Theater.
Yep.
And that's, I'm sure, a huge suck of your time.
Yeah.
In a positive way. A huge, delightful suck of your time.
Yes, right.
But what do you have a title with, you co-founded a theater as well.
Yep, Dalico Arts.
Are you also the managing director of Dalico Arts?
I am a co-artistic director.
Oh, nice, mm-hmm. Nice.
We have not gone the managing director route yet. I'm sure that will happen at some point.
Maybe. I mean, that doesn't ever really have to.
Well,
if you both do a lot of things.
Right. And interestingly, Ben is kind of more interested in that side of it.
Hmm.
He loves the producing part of it.
Well, so. It's very tangible.
Yeah.
You could actually, like, concrete, something happened, I did something.
Yeah.
Like, the creative stuff often is like, it's kind of ongoing, it's never done.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think my first knowledge of you was as a performer. Like, you are an actor.
Yes.
And do you write as well? I assume you write.
I don't
do
know
how
not
much
write.
Creative write. No?
I mean, creatively,
you
I
have
write.
To write.
Yes. But I don't write. I'm not a playwright. I wouldn't call myself.
I really like that you gave it a little breath, though. A
not
playwright.
A playwright.
Yes.
That is a dream of mine someday, but that's like the final frontier. That feels like the scariest part of the work we do, that really intentional storytelling.
Mm.
So someday, maybe.
So you have stories in your head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you start, were you like a little kid actor?
I mean, I was a little, I grew up in rural Iowa. So little kid actor, I guess in the sense that I was taking acting lessons and, you know, in plays there in my community. But, you know, I wasn't like on
I didn't
mean, the boss.
Were you a child actor? Yeah. Wait, you're not Alyssa Milano? I'm sorry, this has been a huge mistake. I really screwed up this booking.
So I kind of knew, I mean, when I was a little kid, I don't know where it came from. Neither of my parents are actors. I mean,
do they both, do other, like, do they have creative
yes,
things?
Yes, they're both singers, actually. I mean, in their free time, and they were always...
Again, they're not Celine
they're
Dion.
Not.
Wow, you are not who I thought you were. Yeah, I thought you were Alyssa Milano, and your mom was Celine Dion.
They were very, I mean, kind of from the beginning, they were very encouraging about all of that. I mean, it was like, you know, whatever you feel led to try it, and let's see where you go in the world with it. So I never had, you know, a lot of my friends had this traditional kind of story about, oh, my parents didn't want me to do that, and I had to fight my way through it. And that was never really the case in our family. And my little sister is also an actor. So whatever it was a genetic bug that caught in this generation.
Just a craving for attention and to be someone else.
Yeah, right, right. Right.
Is that a fair representation of an actor?
Uh-huh. Hi, Mom.
So did you get a theater degree? Did you go to like
I did.
Full?
Yep. You know, I thought I wanted to go to a conservatory and just be like a hoofer. I was all in for musical theater.
And you sang?
As a kid. And that was my favorite thing.
Yeah.
And so I auditioned for conservatories and then ended up at my mom's alma mater. And it was the best, I think the best theater education I could possibly have had at that stage of my life. It was like, here's a piece of gum and a paper clip. Like, make a set and make this all happen. We have no resources to do that for you. So that was fantastic, my undergrad. And then I got an MFA in performance at Mankato. My undergrad was at Truman State. I don't know if I said that, but...
you didn't.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. Keep
Go Bulldogs.
Is that the mascot?
That is.
Yeah. Did the Bulldog show up to theatrical performances?
I'm sure, probably. Maybe without the costume on. What are they called?
The costume. Mascots?
Yeah.
Costume, outfit?
Yeah.
I don't know. I do not know. Now I'm panicked. Is there a word?
Is there a pause? Can we look?
Nope.
Really long story short, I moved to Chicago after I got an MFA and worked there for some tiny companies, and then
Were you going there because there's so many opportunities? Like, you know, it's got a lot of theater, and was that your thinking, or was there?
Yes,
did something else pull you to Chicago?
No, I think I'm just such a hardcore Midwesterner.
Hmm.
Like, I just
well, that's the big city if you're in Iowa, like.
It was
Minneapolis and Chicago,
and
like...
I always wanted to be in Chicago for a while. But I have this really strong Midwestern sensibility. I think I love the sort of I love the sensibilities of Midwesterners. I love this idea that we're in this place and we can be a little self-deprecating, and maybe we're better than we say we are instead of the other way around. And so I was in Chicago for a couple of years, and then went to New York. Decided to try that and I was there for years. And I love New York City. I will always love it. But
what can you articulate what you love about New York City? Is that something you've talked about?
Yes, the energy of New York matches mine. I mean, New York is one of those places where you would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and head out the door for, you know, whatever was happening, and then suddenly it would be 2 a.m. the following morning, and it was like, how did that happen?
Hmm.
I mean, and I loved that. And if you were in sync with that energy. And there were days when I wasn't. You were good. And if you weren't, it was the
just
biggest...
A grind, right?
Grind,
like,
yes. You would just be beat up by it. And it's a complicated place to live because it's unaffordable for most people.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like a lot of like fighting for survival, like just meeting like basic need that I just wasn't that into, I don't think, ultimately. So,
do you feel like that experience serves you well now to run your own arts organization and run another relatively scrappy arts organization, that ability to sort of make a lot with a little that you both get in New York and from here's a stick of gum, build a set, like those are...
Absolutely. I mean, in some ways, not to suggest that it's a bad thing to have resources. It would be great to have them. We
Thank
all
you.
Want them.
That is very true.
Yes.
And if you're a funder listening, like
yes.
that's...
Yes, resources are great. Yeah. But also there's something freeing in the creative process about having very little and being able to say, okay, if we were to think about this a totally different way, how would it work? And something that came out of my time in New York and has really, I think, will probably be one of the anthems of my life at the end of it, is the artist administrator, to me, is such a powerful human. This idea that as artists, I mean, there's always this kind of expectation of artists by civilians that, you know, we're weirdos, right? That we're these people who are incapable of being organized, who can't be left-brain thinkers, who, you know, aren't good with numbers, and you
really
shouldn't
impulsive.
Trust with impulsive.
Yeah.
And all of those things, I mean, those things may be true about some artists, but they're true about some humans. So... On the flip side of that, artists are such remarkable thinkers.
Mm.
And the artists I've worked with who are putting together a project and producing something have by and large been people who are able to say, these are the resources we have, these are the resources we need to have down the road in order to sustain this, this is the money we have to make it work, and let's see what we can do with that and think outside of what a traditional path might be to accomplish it. And I think so much that happens in the world that's good and remarkable and new happens because people think that way.
I really like, I feel like you're articulating something that I like a lot of, the idea that someone who thinks creatively can see how creative a seemingly dull process can be, and can see how much organization a seemingly chaotic process can require to actually thrive, like needing some parameters. Like, I think that's sort of what you're getting at.
Yes.
That if you, the certain brain can go like, this needs chaos to do this totally administrative task. Like,
yes,
it needs a little of that, and this needs a little structure to sort of let the chaos sort of really fully bounce and happen. And
well, and what we know, what I know as a managing director, is when I look at a budget at the beginning of a season, there are multiple unknowns. There are things that we look at in the budget and we go, okay, we have no idea. We can project what ticket sales might look like, but we don't really know.
Right.
And to some people, that's devastatingly uncomfortable. I just don't feel comfortable with that. I don't want that. I want to have some more solidarity, some more certainty about where these numbers are.
Yeah.
You're making me nervous. And the artist administrator, by and large, I mean, I'm making huge generalizations here, but, you know.
You love stereotypes.
I'm trying to sound
if
really
people
confident.
People learn nothing else.
Yeah, right.
It's that you are nothing but a stereotype.
Right, and I love them. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every kind. We'll get into your other favorite stereotypes.
But that idea that, like, an artist administrator, and we have some of them in our office, can say, I'm fine with taking that risk.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's the possibility that we will shut our doors at the end of the season. But the payoff, usually in our office, it's not the financial payoff we're obsessed with. I mean, usually it's...
That's all Nick Split cares about.
It's just
bottom
money.
Line.
But usually this idea that, you know, the payoff socially, the payoff for our community, the payoff in audience development or in the ways that an audience might more deeply engage with what we're doing at Mixed Blood is a phenomenal risk to take.
Or it even feels the national reputation of the organization, which will get other artists to come here to produce work.
Right.
And to be a part of produced work.
Right.
Like, I think one thing that I love about the way Mixed Blood does work is it makes really high caliber actors from all over the world be like, yeah, I'll go do a show in that firehouse. Why wouldn't I? They make amazing work.
Yeah, right.
And that's because of that risk that still exists.
I think so. I think there's an energy in the firehouse. And, you know, we talk a lot about culture.
Yeah.
Company culture, even. I mean, outside of community culture, like,
right,
what does it mean to be Mixed Blood? Like, what is our brand, and how do we function in our offices when no one can see us? And you know,
when you're your true self.
Yeah, like, what is our true self?
Yeah.
Is a great way to put it. And there are some things about Mixed Blood's culture that need to shift. I mean, Mixed Blood is, you know, it started as like this scrappy kid who decided to put on some theater and invited his friends to do it. And it stayed that way for a while. And then at a certain point, it became a teenager. And I think it's now like into burgeoning adulthood on some level. And so those are there are growing pains that are associated with that organizationally. And anyone who's studied organizational development on any level knows that there are those organizational life cycles. So we're at this place right now where it's like, okay, so how do we capture some of that still, like, kids putting on theater kind of feel, and then remain really responsible to the things that we need to remain responsible to? And the culture that has kind of come out of that slowly, we're still working on it, is this, I think, something that has a huge amount of energy under it that feels like there's great flexibility in decision making in that space. So when an artist comes in to work with us, it's not like, well, welcome to Mixed Blood, this is how we do things. It's, you know, now that you're here, inherently things are different. So what are you bringing?
How we do things is how we do things with you.
With you.
Like, that'll be, yeah, it's that collaborative thing. All right, well, so we'll talk about Mixed Blood more.
Great.
But you don't have to just talk about Mixed Blood.
I derailed you, okay.
No, you didn't derail me at all. But just the idea of talking about Mixed Blood's true self, you know, I like to get a little bit of, like, Amanda's true self.
Cool.
To varying degrees of what, you know, where you want to go. But so I do think you being this, you know, you have a lot of training as a performer to go to that much schooling, and then you've put on a lot of shows, both on both sides. You've produced shows you've been a part of, you've just produced shows, but you've also just been a performer in a lot of work in different places in the country. And it's clearly a thing that you're passionate about making work and about performing work. And often the administrative side, while it can be really fulfilling and it can be really creative, there can be this tension of, do I feel like an artist right now? I mean, being an artist is such a self-described, you know, like, for me, I still every day have to decide whether or not to call myself a writer, even though, like, no one else is going to decide if I'm a writer, but I'm like, well, did I write anything yet this morning? You know, like, right. And I think that is a thing artists all, maybe there's some who are like, yeah, I'm an artist. I have no struggle with it at all. But I'm curious, what has the process been for you around identity and how you talk about who you are in relation to the kinds of work you do, both creative and administrative? And, you know, you seem like you don't, your personal life, I think, has to bleed heavily into your professional life. I don't know if you separate at all. Yeah. So what is your identity, and what is that, how has that evolved, or how do you think about it?
Yeah, okay, so.
I know that was like a million things.
No, that's okay. I'll start kind of on that back end. I mean, I think that work-life balance thing, such an adorable conversation. For artists, I feel like, to me, I mean, I guess that I have work-life balance in the sense that I do have work, and also my personal life is so profoundly married to that work. I mean, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, all of the ways.
Yes, in all of the ways. I get to... if I were to pick something to do in my spare time, if I were relaxing, I would be doing theater.
I like the face you made when you said relaxing. That's not a thing that you do, clearly.
But it feels like, I mean, to me, I feel like I have work-life balance, which most people look at me with concern when we talk about that. But truly, I mean, sometimes there are sections of my year that sometimes feel like, okay, this is not sustainable. We can't do this all the time. And then there are times when I feel kind of overcome with gratitude for the opportunity to make this my life. This actually, somehow, it worked out that I am able to practice this in whatever way I can as a life. So, and that's what I wanted. I mean, I am producing shows all the time with people that, and this is Amanda talking, not administrator talking, that I love, people who I love, in my personal realm. Close friends, my husband, colleagues and artists I love a lot as people, and that is really useful. That's been kind of a guiding principle of Delico Arts, is this idea that it's fun to, you know, art is fun, but also to us, like, spending time in our lives should be about spending time with quality human beings who are friendly, who are not buttholes. Right? I mean, that to me feels like something that is important to, you know, if I bring someone who's a jerk into that process, it affects everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone is impacted by it. And everyone goes home at the end of the day being like, oh, I probably should have just gotten a job at Target Corporation. I mean, this is, it's a lot. But when there's more balance, I guess.
I think there's a maturity you need to have. Because I remember a realization of the work that I get to make with Comedy Suitcase of, we had an experience and the show turned out great and it did really well, but the process was not enjoyable for me because of one person. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I don't care how good you are. I'd rather be with someone who's mediocre talented, which luckily I don't even have to. There's plenty of great people. But who makes the... Because the process to me is equal to the product.
Yep.
I think that is...
I feel the same way.
...hurt stuff. But I don't... I think you have to have some experiences of... Even sometimes being the person who's a butthole. I mean, be the butthole sometimes and then be like, oh, I'm mucking this up for everybody.
Yeah. I think that... And there are... What you say is true. There are enough really gifted artists in this community.
Yeah, we don't have to support the...
Who are lovely.
Yeah, the not fun people.
No, we don't. No, we don't. And that also, I think, lends itself to that balance. Like this, I'm surrounded all the time by fantastic human beings. Yeah. That is good enough for me. But yeah, that question of, you know, balancing artist and administrator, one of the things I think was part of that journey for me was, living in New York, I realized a lot of the little companies I was volunteering my time for, like just, you know, as an intern or in the box office, or they were struggling a lot, and some of them fell to the wayside. And a study I was reading a couple of years ago said that, you know, this statistic might be different now, but the average theater company that's like a small company with limited resources will fall apart in 5 years or less, generally speaking. And that proved to be true kind of over and over again as I was working with these little organizations. And one of the things, like I said, I kind of started off, I really just want to be a hoofer. Like, just put me in 42nd Street for the rest of my life, I'm fine. And then as I became kind of more invested in this idea of institutions, like what it's like to actually be a part of something bigger than myself, it occurred to me that maybe I wasn't as interested in that as much as I was interested in this idea that over time, artists can kind of gather around this vision and can support it, and then can, I mean, again, I'm still on the 42nd Street train. I love it. I'll go see it every time. But in addition to that, there are these things that artists do that are just amazing in their community, around economic development, around community relations, around like creative placemaking, that feels to me personally like a rich way to pursue the arts. So, and the way I got at that was, you know, okay, how can I be an artist on the stage and work in that way and contribute sort of what I feel is my heart center as an actor, and then also support that work in other ways by providing resources that contribute to sustainability for this thing that's bigger than me.
That's really interesting. I, more recently than I like to admit, I figured out I really wanted to do more education work with my art practice, and not just teaching the art, but using the tools of the art to teach other things. And I realized I had this sort of bias of doing anything but actually the exact making the exact art felt like a giving up or a failure of some kind, you know, rather than a deepening understanding of what art making could be, or that a career can grow and shift and not, didn't mean the thing didn't work out, you know, like I'm not a professional improviser, which isn't really a thing, sadly, almost everyone. but instead, that wasn't, it didn't work out, but oh, I changed, or I grew, or something like that. Like that, I think that's a common struggle.
I think so. And also, it's like, then how do you, you know, if I wanted to be a professional actor, or if you wanted to be a professional improviser, you know, okay, let's say we figure that out. Well, then there's still this sort of disconnect on some level. It's like going to any other job at the end of the day. You know, if it's not in some way connected to the other ways in which you're living,
right,
then, you know,
it's just one thing.
It's a thing.
Rather than your life.
Yeah. And to me, art making is a life I'm choosing. So it feels like it's necessary to find the connectors there and to figure out, like, if I'm doing this in a vacuum, it might be good in that, I mean, it might, you know, there might be some people with great bios in it, or it might have some excellence of resource, but then, you know, is it just like the tree falling in the forest, sort of?
Do you have like thoughts or experiences with versions of mentorship? I mean, there's some obvious, like, I worked under this person and they showed me a lot of things, and that I'm interested in, but even other, like, do you feel like you've had opportunities to be a mentor yourself at the stage you're at, and do you have people who have sort of served that for you?
Oh gosh, I have thousands of people who've served that for me.
List them all.
Okay, so starting in first grade.
Okay, great.
I'm so scared of that word. I think
I know, that's why I don't know what else, you know, sort of.
That word, I keep touching my microphone, sorry.
Jeez.
That word was like, it's like to me like what writer is to you, maybe, or artist. I would, at the end of my life, I hope that, you know, the part of the well done, good and faithful servant thing is that I have been a mentor. I have not formally mentored people. But, you know, we have interns that come through at Mixed Blood, or staff who will, you know, turn to me with questions, even in life, I guess. But I don't know. That is something that I hope is true. I would
it's
hope
a weird
to
thing
be
to
living
try and
with
go
intention.
After.
Yeah, it is. It
hey,
is.
Can I be your mentor?
You seem like you need some mentorship.
Yeah.
but in terms of being mentored, mm-hmm. I have had the gift of remarkable mentorship, and maybe not in like a long-term sense, but even just case by case. I have always been able to think of someone who may have handled a situation in the way I would want to have handled it. Mm-hmm. And I have had the gift of particularly fantastic women in our profession who have looked out for me, who have said, that is, if you want to go down that path, that's not the way to do it. Or, you know, you should be aware of these pitfalls or develop this skill if you want to go in that direction. And that is something that, even though I'm super glad that there are, you know, all kinds of men involved in the work that we do, I do have a special heart for women in that sense. I read this study recently. I think it might have been TCG that put it out. I'll have to go back and check this source, but
that's the Theater Circle Group. Is that
or Theater what's Communications, the
Communications group.
Group?
I don't know why I always. Yeah. I don't know.
Is it TCG?
No.
Okay, I might be lying. Let's just put that little caveat. But they released this study about leadership in the theater, and 18% of artistic direction or executive leadership, I guess it was, in this country is women in theaters, regional theater,
which 18%. Is high compared to other industries.
Yes. But also still stunning to me. I thought, how can that be? We're so progressive, aren't we?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's still a, is it a glass ceiling? I don't know what it would be made of.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's a glass ceiling. I mean, maybe it's just, you know, issues of representation that we just don't see.
Or women aren't as good.
Or women are not as good. That's possible.
You love stereotypes.
Are you going to clip that into
the soundbite? Yeah, absolutely. That's all this is going to be.
Says Amanda.
Women are not. Every question I ask, it'll just end with, women are not as good.
Yeah. Yep.
I'll find a bunch of isolated quotes to misuse and blackmail you.
Great. That's great.
I mean, I am curious about, I'm happy to hear you talk about the role of women in your life, and I mean, certainly in the arts in general, women in positions of leadership is less uncommon than other spaces.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There is still huge representation issues, and I feel like our society, I don't want to get too like pretentious sounding, is in a really interesting place right now in that it seems like things are really bad, but I think mostly it's a heightened awareness of how bad things have been.
Absolutely.
So the way women are treated online or in life, objectified, and sort of the tiny things have been amplified, I think, where dudes like me are like, oh, I didn't even know that was a thing. I thought I was helping, and mostly I was just not doing anything at all.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if you, how much that informs the work that you do in all the different places. Like, you know, you're curating some content with some of your work, and is that something that you're pulling into consideration when you're doing that work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's been so interesting to be in an executive position at Mixed Blood because I am a white woman. I mean, and
what?
I'm just throwing all kinds of curveballs.
Jeez.
You know, that Mixed Blood, I'm leaving Mixed Blood in June, at the end of June.
See, now I want to say what, like I was shocked, but that I know, and it's not as fun of a game. Yeah.
and you know, partially the reason is that it's just time to have a new chapter in my own life, and I'm looking forward to whatever that is. But also, Mixed Blood, you know, for 40 years, that organization has been helmed by white people.
Well, it's a huge microphone for diversity and equality and inclusiveness. Like,
totally.
That's been a through line.
Yep, and it's been, and I can tell you, when I started working at Mixed Blood, I studied Mixed Blood in college and thought, well, now I'll see the man behind the curtain. I mean, now we'll get the real story here about this guy and about what this organization is. And there just isn't that guy. There's no man behind the curtain. I mean, And that has been, madness happens at Mixed Blood sometimes. I mean, it is, that is the crazy schedule that happens over there. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I have been so happy to be there is...
How long have you been with...
This is my fifth year. Okay. Is there... That place is as genuine as it gets about really going after those issues, those social justice issues, and pursuing them pretty doggedly, actually, and in some sometimes really risky ways.
Seems like a willingness to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Mixed Blood.
Back to that artist skill set, too. Yeah. Like, how can we be professionally uncomfortable all the time? And I think the organization is now in that place, and Jack will tell you this too, I think, that it now needs, its leadership needs to be reflective of its communities on some level. And Jack is not going anywhere for a while, nor should he. He has a lot going on. But I think it's time, I'm putting this call out to the board of directors here on the podcast. I think
this is the best way to talk to your board of
directors.
Yeah,
yeah. Best practices.
Fold it right into here. A personal narrative.
And they all know this, too. Like, it's time for a leader of color at that organization. That has been an interesting process for me, those issues of representation in leadership. Mm-hmm. Like, thinking about, okay, so what are the ways in which I can make myself vulnerable to other stories, like to other ways of living or being, and what are the things that I have absolutely, it's like you say, what have I missed? Like, what are the things I may think I'm kind of on top of it as an ally in some respect for any number of communities, but like, what are the ways in which I'm totally missing the picture or like actually even being harmful when I was trying so hard to be helpful? And
that's the hardest, I think, to really truly look at.
Oh,
to
my
go
gosh.
And look where you might be wrong. When you thought you were so right,
is
I think there's a lot of the sort of emotion people react to, especially the race conversation happening right now, is this fear of I've been wrong this whole time, like, and then am I a monster? Like, that's really scary. Like, I get.
Well, I think it's because we think a lot about equality as opposed to egalitarianism.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that there's this. Equality is perhaps the wrong way of thinking about the world. And now that, you know, arguably, I suppose, do I mean this? You know, if it's...
So excited for whatever you're going to say.
Things seem like they're getting... I mean, in my lifetime, they seem like they've become worse and worse and worse. But perhaps it's... Perhaps that's not true. Perhaps we're just... Those of us who have experienced privilege and continue to experience it, or who have benefited from systems, knowingly or unknowingly, we're just now getting a sense of a thing that has been really just completely predominant in our country and in any number of cultures.
I feel like it's an awareness more than a move backwards.
Yeah.
It's a, oh.
Yes.
For me, that's a lot of, like, when I've gone to rallies and things and do read things, and I'm like, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, and we talk about the difference between equality and egalitarianism at Mixed Blood a lot, like what that really means and what it requires of communities to sort of see the difference. And I think that egalitarianism is, you know, it's the harder call to action for people who've experienced privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So... You know, and I don't know, I guess if, I mean, is it useful for me to, like, say, to define that, those terms? Like, I don't know if...
Egalitarianism?
Yeah, as opposed to equality, or, like, when
do
I...
Do you have? Yeah, I don't know if you have definitions. I think I know what you mean, but...
Well, I guess,
even just you, the example of you deciding I should, you're leaving for your own reasons, but also you leaving is creating space where there's not representation and should be.
Yes, and to be clear, and I'm not being a martyr here. It is my own decision to move on.
Fine.
Yes. But
that's not just an equality. Equality is like we put out an RFP, anyone could apply. We weren't saying no to anyone who would apply for this position as opposed to we're going to go and make sure we're reaching out to, I mean, you should, this is not a good definition of egalitarianism, but I think specific to that, sort of the idea of trying to fill that position, people see something like Title IX about women having access to athletics the same way men have. and people feel that that is some sort of helping of, you know, the people who will argue against it is like, well, now it's giving an advantage to somebody else.
Well, it's like, okay, so this is perhaps a really oversimplified way of describing it. I was just trying to think of a story.
I just think it's good that you and I are the ones trying to break down race relations. I think that's ideal.
White people break it down. Yep. This is the only way I can, I guess this is just a really sort of simple way of saying it. Like, let's say, can I use your daughter as an example?
Sure. Great. For what? Yeah, go ahead.
In this story.
Yeah.
Like, let's say you and your daughter decide you're going to go apple picking and participate in this pie making contest at the apple orchard.
Sounds fun. Okay. I mean,
this is going to be the dumbest comparison. So you go and together you enter this contest and you come to Amanda's apple orchard, and at that apple orchard we believe in equality. Mm. So you've come late in the season, all the like literal low-hanging fruit is gone, right? So I'm going to give you and your daughter both ladders. And they're equal ladders. We're equality people here. So I give you the ladder, and I give your daughter the ladder, and they're the same ladders. And you go out, and you do the apple picking. And you come back with this huge, you know, bucket of apples.
Yeah.
And she has very few apples because your ladders are the same size. So it's like, I'm assuming she's littler than you.
She is, yes.
So
she's
so,
not a deformity
right.
as of yet.
She's in elementary school,
yeah. Yes. I have a couple feet on her. Yep. Yeah.
So you come back.
Also, and, I'm really good at picking apples.
Right. So. Well, there's that too. So you come back and we have the pie making contest, and she only makes a pie and you have like eight pies, and then we all roll our eyes at the fact that she wasn't able to produce in the same way. So that's equality. And then egalitarianism is if I give you ladders comparable to your height, because
right.
I know that your daughter, given the resources to support her, has huge capacity to make as many apple pies as you
right.
do. So, like, I guess that's the description.
I like that. It's more about what's just.
And also knowing
equal.
That you come to the table with, you come in
yeah,
already
I have an advantage.
With an advantage
yeah.
because
yeah.
you're taller. That's perhaps a little dangerous.
No,
there,
I like it.
But,
no, I think that's good.
But yeah, that idea that, you know.
To try to come with an example that is not already politicized or heated is really hard, too. Like,
it
that
is,
one
yeah,
is, there's no,
is.
Like, there's not many trigger warnings attached to the apple picking. Maybe. Who knows? Maybe someone's like, that's a misrepresentation of apple picking.
Yeah, right,
like, what?
Right.
That's not really the point.
With apologies to area orchards. So yeah, I don't know. I guess I just. Oh my gosh, I can't remember why we're talking about this.
I just asked what you had for breakfast. And
okay.
You just started talking about race and then apple picking. I don't
apple
know,
jacks,
it got real
apple
weird.
Apple jacks.
You clearly have an agenda.
But that's something I think about a lot. There
yeah.
we go. Is this idea that, you know, in leadership in our field, that there are, you know, ultimately, and again, this is not what I'm doing. I'm just suggesting that this is what will have to happen, that those of us who have been given ultimate resources to step to lead organizations will have to make cognizant decisions to step away from leadership and allow marginalized, which is another tricky word,
yeah.
or unheard voices to step forward and to sort of take those realms. Or take those helms. I mean, that's
and realms,
and operate in those realms. That is a scarier thing to talk about, right?
Yeah.
For those of us who have like been privileged and who have had those opportunities.
Well, especially because, you know, when you say privileged, like I grew up poor and was raised by a single mother.
Yeah.
But my mother had a college education.
Yeah.
I have white skin.
Yeah.
I was treated differently from the day I was born. I am still from a place of privilege, even
yeah.
though we had food stamps sometimes. But just the way I'm treated by the world, like when I walk into a place, has always been different than people differently looking than me.
Totally. And it's hard to think about even just the way systems are constructed. I mean, you think about maybe we're going down a road you don't want to go down, but...
we're there already.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do this.
As long as there's pie, that's what you talked about.
Schools, churches, community centers, you know, a lot of those are westernized. Mm-hmm. They're constructed in ways that, you know, Western cultures constructed them here in our country.
Yeah.
And so, like, already there's this expectation that there is otherness if you are not aligned with whatever these Western constructs are.
Yeah.
And so we may never feel as white people that level of privilege, but it is absolutely systemic. And that can be really scary because, you know, there are all these questions. I have them all the time. Okay, so where do we start? So if my church has a westernized construct, what do I do about that? How can I support? And as an artist, because that is how I come to the world, what I can do, maybe one thing I can do, is assist in helping other stories told.
Yeah.
Like letting those become normalized, if you will. Letting those become things that are not other, that are just part of the stories that are told in our country.
Well, so how could that look for Dalico Arts, your theater company, which is mostly, you're producing work in, is it rural Minnesota? Like, what's the right terminology for
it? I mean,
it
doesn't quite feel like rural Minnesota, although I think, like, a lot of the sort of demographic reports you would read might say that. It's a little more like...
Like outer suburban?
Outer suburb, yeah, I would say so. There's a lot of farmland in New Prague, but I don't know if I'd call it really rural.
But, I mean, New Prague is a sort of German settlers, like very traditional...
Czech settlers.
Yeah.
Yep. It's almost, I would say, I mean, not entirely, but almost entirely white people live
there.
How
do you and your husband, Ben, if at all, decide we're going to make sure different stories and different voices are represented to a community who isn't mostly of those voices?
Yeah.
And you guys aren't of these different voices. Like, that's tricky too.
Super tricky.
Especially because you don't want to be like heroes. You know, you don't want to do that, like, tokenizing or something.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
So.
And you also have your own, like, these are the things I like and care about. So, like, you want to do good work and maybe have a little bit of activism pulled into the work you're doing, but you don't want it to just be that.
That is a huge challenge. And I would actually love a world symposium of artistic directors to talk. I mean, this issue is, like, central, right, to institutional art making.
Right.
Like, what are the ways in which we pursue individual aesthetic and also serve communities? Mm. Huge. I think that for us, it started out, I'm going to admit total stupidity here in the beginning because it was super embarrassing. I mean,
you couldn't put on shoes.
I could not even
total
put on
stupidity.
Shoes. We put together this, you know, we underestimated our audience, which I think happens. We thought, okay, this is a community that, you know, they love theater. There are several community theaters in New Prague. The kids get involved in the arts from early ages. You know, they're supportive, hugely supportive of the arts, and they've proven it for the last several years to us. But we thought, like, oh, not really like a schooled theater-going audience in that they will, like, know the drill. It has not become part of their sort of regular lives to go to the theater and participate in a process and consider it a community voice. So we decided in our first couple of seasons we would do these, like, awesome. I mean, I love all these old chestnuts, but they're chestnut plays and musicals, like just classic kind of dinner theater fare, Forever Plaid, The Odd Couple, you know, you name it. And some of them are just, they're plays I love.
Yeah, but, and people really know what to expect.
And people know
what
to
expect.
It's
what you think of when you think theater, if you... You know, come from where we come from.
Yeah. And, I've heard of that movie, like, if I haven't heard of that play. So we did that, and it was fine. Audiences were amazing in terms of, like, their support right out of the gate, like, subscribing to season memberships, like, just completely connecting instantly.
Now you're just bragging.
Right.
Go on.
And it was like, you know, they were great. They liked it. But we decided the first season we did 4 shows in a summer, crazed, and we were in the middle school in New Prague, and we decided, okay, this last show we're gonna do a little bit of an envelope pusher, like a tiny, tiny bit, and we did Proof. You know, there are some swears in it. And this elderly woman came up to me after one of the shows, and she said, "Well, you finally decided to do something grown up." And it was like, okay, so maybe we've made all of these assumptions mm-hmm. about these people. And so over the next several years, we have committed to figuring out what is the way that we have a conversation with that community? Mm-hmm. Like, how do we say, come in and let's talk about the work we've done, and let's talk about what you're interested in hearing about, but also what we're interested in talking about, and get a strong sense of how Delico Arts might serve in a broader sense than as, you know, just a kind of dinner theater-y space. Mm-hmm. It's not a dinner theater, but I'm just like thinking about like the kind of fare that, like that very comfortable, lovely, fun theater experience.
Yeah.
We still want to have those. And then sometimes there are bigger conversations to have. Like, what does it mean if we are a largely white community of people right on the outskirts of a major metropolitan area?
With growing waves of migration and immigration.
Huge waves.
Butting up against a new Prague.
Yes.
I mean that.
Yes. So Mixed Blood and Delico Arts joined this year the Jubilee. And I don't know if you read about this.
You talk a little bit about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So Howl Round, you know, the national kind of this national theater journalism outlet.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Absolutely yeah. not the
Nailed
way they would
it.
Describe themselves.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a, like, open, in some ways, open source way of talking about theater on the national
yeah.
level.
They have a lot of guest writers from all over the place.
Yes.
They're having conversations about
yes.
lots of current issues in theater and
yes.
art.
And there are some rad people over there.
Yeah.
And they've started this movement called the Jubilee, which is this commitment that in the year 2020, that season, whatever that means for your organization, you would commit, theater producers at the institutional level will commit to producing only works written by artists of color, women, or underrepresented communities like the LGBT communities or, you know, communities that are may be misrepresented in terms of gender or sexual identity, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Seems really simple to me. It caused such an uproar. It was like, but wait, so no white men will be produced in the entire year? I wish that that was like a momentary problem that we had. I don't think that will happen. I mean, I think there are like 60 theaters or something that
yeah.
got on board so far. It's still not too late to sign up your theater. And the idea being not like, let's get rid of the male voice, the white male voice.
Good luck.
Absolutely not.
That,
like,
that
right.
That isn't happening.
Yes, let's not
do it.
I don't
know what everyone's so afraid of.
But what would happen if for a year we elevated these other voices?
Right.
Like, just let them kind of take front and center. Wouldn't it then just sort of enrich the future?
No, people would realize that white men aren't that interesting. And that causes all kinds of unraveling.
That is not true. I know a lot of you.
You know a few. We're just passing.
But that idea that Delico Arts is doing this, which it was funny, we got a little bit of press about it, and the community, I thought, well, now there's going to be a little pushback. The community is going to be like, whoa, wait, you know, what happened to Forever Plaid? And they were all super excited about it. We got, I mean, I don't know if all of them.
You talk to
every single
patron. Person.
But the feedback we got from people was, this is so cool. I love that there's this progressive voice happening in our community, and that's exciting to us. And, you know, so I'm hoping that as we kind of, it's a journey, just like, I guess, any other kind of artistic process is. So I think over the next couple of years, it will be interesting to see how we move more toward, and this, I'm stealing some Mixed Blood language here, like more toward how, like, what happens inside the theater is reflective of what happens outside. And when I say that, I mean like maybe in a broader scope, as
yeah.
well as what happens in that community.
Yeah.
We try to sometimes tell really new Prague-specific stories too. So, see how it goes.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you a question, tangentially related. I think it touches on things we've talked about.
Cool.
Of how embedded you are in your work, and your work is embedded in you.
Yeah.
You have a husband who with whom you run a theater.
I do.
And you've shared theater in all the different ways with your husband. Like, you guys have done all the different things you can do with theater together. Do you have to be mindful, or are you able to have your relationship exist outside of theater, or is that something that's of value? Working together, even if it's on something you're deeply passionate about, can raise the risk of, oh, this is what we share. You know, is there anything else to us? You know, so how do you navigate that, or is that not really an issue?
It's a huge issue, and I don't think it's like specifically necessarily a huge issue for us, but alone. But I mean, yes, it's major. That is such a complicated thing. There are days when I think, was this a good idea? I mean, truly. And then other days when I know
and
it
you're,
was.
You know, you're leaving ostensibly to put more time into Dalico, too. So
yep. That is one of my dreams. Yeah, I think, and what it does is, like, really amplify. And I don't know if you ever get to work with Laura.
Yeah, she's in a show we're doing in March right now.
Awesome. By the way, there's one of my mentors.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. I think it sort of amplifies everything in your relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are times when we both look at each other and think, like, are you serious right now? Are you serious? And then other times when you think, you are the best person I have ever known at doing that thing you just did. Mm-hmm. Or Ben is the best arts marketer I've ever met. Mm-hmm. And has not practiced it for an organization prior to Dalico Arts. So, in project-based things, maybe.
Sold.
But it's challenging in that, like, everything is kind of married. I mean, the success of, like, even how Tech Week is going, or what ticket sales look like, or whether or not we have everything organized for the rent, you know, on our little space for the next month, or all of those little pressures, like, completely weigh in to how we function together. We both have weird schedules. So, you know, what happens usually is 6:30 a.m. or some iteration on that, we're up and out the door, and then we're back at 11 p.m. and it's high five, how was your day? Great, bye. So I guess, you know, just like, I think if we maybe had children, it might be a different thing.
It'd be worse.
It seems like it would be like, the pressure would certainly be bigger.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of what happens with, you have this shared thing you're working on.
Yeah.
But it takes up all your time. And then when you're together, you're talking about that shared thing. I mean, that is very similar to, you made a person. Well, when we're together, we're talking about that person. And you have to remember to, like, wait, what did we like about each other before? Because we should have other things to talk about.
Yeah, totally.
And that can happen with, sure, you were talking about theater before, but now you're talking about the theater project that you're both engaged in. And then you're like, oh, wait, can we talk about, like, a book or a TV show? Or is there anything else in our lives that we have in common anymore? Or is this, if this thing fails, are we done?
Yeah. Well, and there's something, too, about, like, and maybe we have a weirdo marriage. I don't know.
Probably.
Well, yeah, we do, for sure. But there's this idea that, you know, Ben and I are married, and I love that I'm married to him. But also, my life does take a lot of different turns. So, you know, we both are pretty independent people.
Yeah, you're not glued to each other all the time. Yeah.
We're not. And a lot of my free time, I mean, the things that I'm like, I'm going to go camping for 5 days, or I'm going to read this huge novel all day, nobody talk to me, or whatever. Those are not things that are interesting to Ben at all. Mm. And he has his things that also I don't find that interesting. So, you know, figuring out also how to, like, have those separate lives and to just be our own people, too, I think is really important.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Really important.
Yeah, that's underrepresented in marriages, romantic partnerships in general.
Yeah, completely.
My wife and I really bristle at the idea of two halves becoming whole. She's like, that's a terrible idea.
It's a horrible idea.
You were half a person the whole time before.
Right.
But, yeah, I really like that. We have our own worlds, and sometimes they intersect and sometimes they don't.
Me too.
It seems really important.
Me too. I like that idea of, I mean, I am fortunate to have a partnership with someone who sort of sees this long-term vision in a way that I also see it. So the coolest thing about being married and being in this process is, like, I am working toward something with this person. Mm-hmm. That feels like a good reason to have a life partnership.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I like that.
When you probably have to check in on the sort of strength of your communication more often.
Yeah.
Because not just your relationship is dependent on it, but this other thing that you're sort of directly engaged in.
Absolutely.
Sort of like forces your hand a little bit. So it's harder maybe to even take each other for granted. I don't know.
Well, and you guys probably sense, you know, I don't mean to like loop you into this personally, but you,
let's
maybe you feel this feel this way. You know, there is a public, you do sort of have a public persona as a couple.
Yeah.
Like, there's this, you know, oh, that's a Ben and Amanda thing that happens. And so, you know, being able to like get up on the stage together and give the curtain speech and give the impression that like we're a unit.
And you're holding hands the whole time.
Totally. Yes, right. That idea of like, you know, it's important to our guests on some level that we seem like we're this, you know, family that's creating this mm-hmm. work together. So, and of course we are. It's not like...
Yeah, wait a minute,
Charlotte.
What are you admitting?
Yeah.
It's all a ruse.
No, but I mean, there is that extra pressure of like, you know, sometimes the day is long. Like if you're like, if, you know, something will happen at the box office we're trying to sort out and we're both agitated about it and the first person comes in and you do the like facelift and smile, like, come on in, hi. And so those are challenges too,
yeah.
That, you know, they're awesome challenges. I guess I wouldn't trade them.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, Ben is the funniest dude I have ever known who does not share my blood. And also, I want him to be proud of me and to be proud of my work. So
you'll get there. Just keep at it.
I'm crossing my fingers one day. But that's a driver, too, in my life. You know, if this person who I want to admire me is working alongside me and, you know, is seeing kind of how I'm approaching the world and how I'm working as an artist, then... It's not a bad kind of pressure to have.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Where would you point people on the internet to see your various things that you're working on?
So if you want to check out Mixed Blood, what we have going on, mixedblood.com, or we are on Twitter at @mixed_blood. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram, Mixed Blood Theater. And for Daleko Arts, it's DaleKoArts.com. Hmm. And we're also on Instagram and Twitter at Daleko Arts.
Can you quick say where Daleko Arts, the name, comes from?
Yes.
Because I know it's not a
yes.
Doctor Who reference.
Daleko Arts is a Czech word because New Prague is a Czech community by and large. And Daleko means far away. And it comes from this... You know that old, so when Ben and I were like brainstorming, what do we want this company to be about and what makes then sense as a way of kind of framing that? That poster of the Earth from far, far away, it's called the Blue Dot.
Yeah, the Blue Dot,
I think,
yeah.
The Blue Dot. So we were looking at that poster. Both of us kind of kept coming back to it as we were talking about like the way that artists work in the world. And so the Daleko comes from this notion that like artists are capable of kind of stepping back from something and observing it and telling a story about it and perhaps inhabiting another experience or seeing something from another angle. So that's what that is.
Cool. I like that.
Thanks.
And then you personally, is there, or follow you on Twitter? Is that a thing
yes,
you don't
yes.
push?
Yes, yes. I am on Twitter at Amanda TG. That's my married name. So it's Amanda TheiTje. I have a show coming up.
Yeah, when's your show?
I'm opening Doubt at Artistry this Friday. I'm playing Sister Aloysius.
That's awesome.
Please cross your fingers.
Fantastic.
I think it'll be fun. Thanks.
Well, thanks for talking to me, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah.
This was really fun.
Hooray.
It's always such a pleasure. Remember when you tried to kill me twice? And how we laughed and laughed, except I wasn't laughing. Under the circumstances, I've been shockingly nice. You want your freedom, take. mind is heavy.